his organization won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2020, shortly after Baron Seeger joined them to head the American branch of the World Food Program. He updates us today on Travel with Rick Steves on their efforts to combat global hunger during an unusually challenging time in the world. And we pay tribute to the life and work of journalist and writer Tom Miller, who spent his days chronicling life in Latin America, the U.S. Southwest, and along the Mexican border. Ever since 1621, Americans have been celebrating their gratitude for their prosperity by inviting the neighbors over for a big Thanksgiving meal. It became a national holiday back in the 19th century. Food historian Sarah Lohman joins us now for a closer look at what Thanksgiving represents in American history and what you might get to eat.
Hello. Hi, Rick.
So good to be with you. And have you been sort of fantasizing about big Thanksgiving gatherings and traditional meals?
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah, my mom, she does like the classic spread in Northeast Ohio. Sweet potatoes, green bean casserole, mashed potatoes, stuffing, turkey, a lot of brown foods. That's how we like to eat in the Midwest.
Brown foods, that's right. Now Thanksgiving really has a legendary beginning way back in the 1621 or so. And it was a celebration. You know, the romantic notion is the colonists and the Native Americans are getting along. Let's have a big dinner together and so on. But really, Thanksgiving is a 19th century thing that we have today. Tell us about the evolution of Thanksgiving, how we look at it since the Civil War until what we do today.
Yeah, so it was a real event that happened in 1621, a harvest celebration between the colonists at Plymouth and the Wampanoag people. And it was this moment of peace and sharing resources and 3 days of celebration and joy. So to me, it's like, in a way, it's very bitter and sad of how all things ultimately turned out in the relationships between Indigenous people and the white colonists. Interestingly, though, it didn't become an American holiday until the turn of the 19th century, and it came in this wave of nostalgia after 1776, looking back at the original colonizing of our country, and with historians. Like, it was kind of a new thing in the early 19th century to study history. So the first time we actually see that event referenced as the first Thanksgiving isn't until the 1830s. And then it wasn't until Abraham Lincoln in the 1860s that it was declared a national holiday. And that's because of, honestly, a lot of letter writing by a woman named Sarah Hale, who believed that we really needed a uniting moment during the Civil War.
Was this a patriotic thing more than a religious thing? Because I've always thought different cultures give thanks to whoever they worship for having the harvest. It's kind of a harvest festival. We call it Thanksgiving, but other countries have a similar festival the same time of the year, and it always coincides with the harvest.
You know, the idea of a day of Thanksgiving is a very religious idea for the puritanical pilgrims at Plymouth. Ooh, that was hard to say. A day of Thanksgiving was declared when something incredible had happened that they attributed to God. So, you know, giving this the name Thanksgiving, it does have heavy religious connotations. But as the holiday, I think, has evolved over the past 150 years, I think many of those have been removed for families who are not Christian and are not religion, that it's a day of getting together with family or chosen family and really stuffing yourself on some incredible food.
Because that's what it is now. I know you think of the very humble family gathering where people are just thankful to have their daily bread and they'll say a nice prayer of thanksgiving to God, regardless of their religion. Today, it's kind of a excuse to watch football, get together and have a big feast and get together with loved ones.
Oh my gosh, but that's sort of what I love about reading accounts of Thanksgiving in the 19th century, because it was the same thing. Yeah. You know, writers talk about that, like, you're eating all day and then people are going outside to play games and then coming back in for another slice of cake. And Thanksgivings in the 19th century were gigantic. Families were bigger. They often lived closer. And they really did all come into the matriarch and patriarch's household. So the menus from the 19th century, it's an incredible amount of food.
Well, let's talk about that. If you were a matriarch and you had all the loved ones, many generations coming together, and you all lived in the same community anyway, so this is just a great chance to all get together, what would you be serving in the 1800s?
Okay, well, I mean, are you ready? Because I have an actual menu that was published in an Ohio cookbook from 1877 called Buckeye Cookery. Shall I do a reading for you?
Give it to me, yeah.
Okay. Thanksgiving dinner, oyster soup, boiled fresh cod with egg sauce, roast turkey, cranberry sauce, roast goose, bread sauce or currant jelly, stuffed ham, applesauce or jelly, pork and beans, mashed potatoes and turnips, delicate cabbage, canned tomatoes and corn, baked sweet potatoes, boiled onions, salsify, macaroni and cheese, brown bread and superior biscuit, lobster salad, pressed beef, cold corned beef tongue, celery, cream slaw, watermelon, peach, pear or apple, sweet pickles, bell peppers, peaches or cucumbers, chow chow, tomato ketchup, stewed peaches or prunes, donuts and ginger cakes.
Okay, hang on. Let's do dessert in a minute.
But we're just at dessert.
I want to have dessert later, but I want to digest what you've just done. So think of all that food. Is that an exaggeration or do you really believe that's what they served?
I mean, let's just talk about the meat selection there. I mean, turkeys could be as big as they were now, but that was kind of rare. So turkeys were smaller and families were bigger. So you're going to have your turkey, yes, but you're also going to have a chicken pie, which is basically a big chicken pot pie. And it's not unusual to have a couple different types of game meat like venison, but also this menu says, you know, throw some ham in there too, you know?
Yeah. And it's all seasonal, obviously. It's all local, obviously.
I would think it's local. Did you catch the canned corn and beans?
I heard canned. Did they have canned food back then?
Absolutely, but it was pretty new and trendy. So putting that on your table was both exciting because it was new technology, but it also meant that you could have corn in the early winter, which is something we take for granted now, but would be really unusual in the 19th century.
Wow. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with culinary historian Sarah Lohman. She's compiled a history of 8 key ingredients in the American cuisine, and that's her book, 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Her latest book is called Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods, and you'll see her work in the New York Times, in Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. You can learn more about Sarah's work at her website at sarahlohman.com, L-O-H-M-A-N. And today, Sarah is priming us for the most unforgettable Thanksgiving feast you could ever imagine. Sarah, review with us in this 1870s super-duper Thanksgiving menu. Now, let's say, okay, you went out and played touch football or whatever you did 150 years ago.
Right.
I like to take a break before the pumpkin pie and everything. But now, what is the dessert course?
Okay, so desserts, after we have all of our meat and sides and veggies, we have donuts and ginger cakes, minced pumpkin and peach pies, plum and boiled Indian puddings, apple, coconut, or almond tarts, vanilla ice cream, old-fashioned loaf cake, pound cake, black cake, white perfection cake, ribbon cake, almond layer cake, citron, peach, plum, or cherry preserves, apples, oranges, figs, grapes, raisins, and nuts, and then, of course, tea and coffee.
Wow. Now, would it be a dry society, or would they have beer or wine or hard liquor?
Probably cider, honestly.
Cider.
We were big cider drinkers, certainly. By the 1870s, maybe beer. That beer is thanks to the big German immigration in the middle of the 19th century. Depends on where you live. And sure, there might be a little bit of whiskey for the men after dinner.
You know, that was the time when people had traditional roles. The man would be out there chopping wood, and the woman would spend the whole day in the kitchen, I suppose, for this. Can you paint a picture of how that community came together and how it functioned?
Sure. I mean, it really was, if we're talking agrarian society, shared but equal work, it really wasn't until industrialization that women got placed into sort of a lesser role, because men are caring for the animals and then slaughtering them, but women are doing all of the processing. So it's just kind of two different roles that would come together. Everything has been brought in, the animals have been slaughtered. So like, it's a time when you can really celebrate bounty.
Sarah Lohman is helping us view America through its traditions around the big Thanksgiving meal. Sarah works with museums and other institutions around the country to create public programs focused on food. She's formerly the curator of food programming at New York City's Lower East Side Tenement Museum. Sarah offers a culinary history of America in her book, 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Her latest book, Endangered Eating, highlights local foods and rare ingredients that are in danger of being lost and how we can save them by eating them. We have links to her work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. When we think back in the 1870s, like you just read us that menu, How does that translate to today and our sort of our consuming habits today? In other words, let's say you have the honor of preparing a great Thanksgiving dinner for a great family gathering right now into the 21st century. How would you see that meal? What would you serve? And what would you like to see served?
Well, you know, what I think is so interesting about this menu is even though it is massive, we can spot those dishes which are still must-haves, at least for a good New England or Midwestern Thanksgiving. The turkey at the center, mashed potatoes, pumpkin pie, cranberry sauce, apple pie, it's all there. I mean, I think that we have to add green bean casserole, which is actually a 1950s creation. It was invented in 1955 by a woman named Dorcas Riley, who worked in the Campbell's Soup Test Kitchen and wanted to create a simple side dish with minimum ingredients that all housewives would have on hand, including canned green beans and cream of mushroom soup. But one of the most awesome things I think about Thanksgiving in the 21st century is that it's really made personal in the side dishes. You know, whether you're having lasagna or empanadas on the side, usually those dishes around the turkey speak to your own heritage.
It's interesting. When I think back on my family Thanksgivings, each person had the side dish that the mother or whatever knew was really important to that person.
Yeah,
Jan wants the cranberries and Linda wants the stuffing and Rick really loves black olives to put on his fingers or whatever, you know. And it is something that it's near and dear to our hearts. It's an emotional thing.
Yeah, a family menu is canon, right? If you change something, people are going to be upset.
That's so true. And I just want to finish off our discussion and thank you so much, Sarah Lohman, for joining us. But the big question in my mind would be your advice for the pie, pumpkin, apple, or mincemeat?
Oh my gosh, why not all three? My mom makes four different desserts for an 8-person Thanksgiving.
There you go. Well, happy Thanksgiving and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. You too.
Up next, the head of the World Food Program in the U.S. tells us about their work going after the causes of hunger and poverty in a world where conflict, corruption, climate change, and a pandemic have posed their own set of challenges. It's Travel with Rick Steves.